The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 18 points today. It closed at 2,358. That's of interest because it was 10 years ago today that the Nasdaq hit its all-time high, 5,048. Nasdaq is home to a lot of the internet and telecom stocks that shot into the stratosphere during the dot-com boom. When the tech bubble burst, it left scars on the economy that we're still feeling. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
WorldCom, AOL, Yahoo, there was a time that stocks like these traded at astronomical levels. If you owned them, you just had to sit back and watch them rise in value. And even though a lot of people warned that the tech surge wouldn't last, stocks kept climbing, says Jeremy Siegel of the Wharton School.
Bubbles always go further than anyone expects, and this one certainly did.
This boom in tech stocks really took off in the 1990s, a reaction to the digital revolution, which was already radically changing the way so many industries operated. Companies that hadn't existed a few years before had suddenly become powerful forces in the economy.
How about sending your mom some nice flowers? All you do is click on Marketplace, we place an order.
Call now for America Online, a new way to use your computer to communicate, have fun, and get instant news and information.
By the year 2000, any company with .com in its name could make investors swoon, even if it had no profits and no real hope of earning any. There was a new paradigm in the economy, or so it seemed. Dave Kirsch teaches at the University of Maryland's Smith School of Business.
I had students who were rushing off to start companies, and I thought, gee, well, you know, what am I doing here? I would try and teach strategy in the classroom, and the students would look at me like, that was yesterday's news. And I started to believe it.
But bubbles burst, and this one did too. On March 10th, tech stocks began a fall they've never really recovered from. Why it happened then is something economists are still studying. Kirsch says internet sales had been disappointing during the holidays.
It's as those data start to come out in early 2000 that investors start to realize not everyone can be Amazon. Not everyone can succeed and get big fast.
Then, too, the Y2K scare was over, which meant tech spending by companies was down. Jonathan Coleman of Janus Capital says investors started getting nervous.
I think the market over long periods of time can vacillate between fear and greed. We were coming off an extended era of greed. Once the market started to crack, I think a lot of investors looked up and fear started to take over.
In the carnage that followed, a lot of new tech companies went under, but not all of them. David Kirsch has studied about 1,000 of the internet companies born during the late 90s. Nearly half still exist today. Kirsch says many of these are smaller companies that found a retail niche and took advantage of it. Today, he says these companies make decent profits, but they probably won't ever make a killing in the market.
So in some sense, the firms that succeeded were the firms that didn't fall victim to get big fast, that followed basic business practices.
The technology sector as a whole is now healthy. Companies like Oracle and Cisco are stalwarts of the stock market, but Jeremy Siegel says they're still well short of the heights they hit a decade ago.
If you survive the recession of 2002, you're probably going to be around, but you probably will not enjoy the price that you had experienced back then a decade ago, maybe never again.
Siegel notes that the Nasdaq Composite Index is still 50% below where it was a decade ago. But, he says, it took almost 30 years for the Dow Jones Industrial Average to recover all the ground it lost in the crash of 1929. And it could take just as long for the tech sector to recover this time around. Jim Zeroli, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Bank of America says it will do away with overdraft charges on debit card purchases. When customers try to buy something but don't have enough in their account, the transaction will simply be rejected. Consumer groups are cheering this move, but warn that it's one more reason for cardholders to keep a close eye on their statements. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
Overdraft fees from debit cards have become a huge source of income for banks, to the tune of about $20 billion a year. Here's how it works. Say your checking account is running on empty, but you don't realize it. You go to your favorite coffee place for a latte, swipe your debit card, the payment goes through just fine, and then bam, a $35 fee. Bank of America is saying no more.
You will never at Starbucks have a $40 cup of latte.
Susan Faulkner is a senior vice president at Bank of America. As of early June for new customers and early August for existing customers, Bank of America will stop charging overdraft fees on debit transactions. So if there isn't enough money in the account,
we would just not authorize that transaction to go through.
You'd be denied.
You'd be denied, therefore you don't incur that additional fee.
Bank of America is the second major bank to move in this direction. Citibank was the first. Both are going beyond what's required by the Federal Reserve's new rules. Those rules, set to take effect this summer, require banks to get their customers to opt in if they want automatic overdraft protection on their debit cards. These banks are apparently betting that most of their customers, faced with a decision, will opt out. Faulkner says Bank of America is simply doing what its customers want.
They just said, if I'm going to overdraw my account, don't let me. Just don't let me spend the money that I don't have.
One question is just how much this move will cost Bank of America. The company isn't yet saying, but it could be hundreds of millions of dollars. Richard Beauvais says losing overdraft fee income is certainly going to cut into profitability. He's a banking industry analyst at Rockdale Securities.
It's reasonable to assume that the banks will be closing branches, reducing the hours that they're open, eliminating free checking or putting such high balance requirements on it to get the free checking that the whole cost of consumer banking in the United States is going to go up.
Beauvais expects the industry to refocus its efforts on its most profitable customers and even push out those who aren't.
We're going to see a change in the nature of banking in the United States for the consumer, and the consumer is definitely not going to like it.
We're already starting to see additional new little tricks and traps and fees jump up and pop out at consumers.
Christina Edmondson with Consumers Union says consumers will need to be more vigilant than ever, checking their statements for new unexpected fees.
Banks are starting to charge fees for simply closing an account or inactivity on an account. Some banks may also start charging an administrative fee for just mailing a paper statement to your house each month.
Bank of America, for its part, insists there are no new or hidden fees associated with its announced overdraft changes. One more thing, debit card fees may be on the way out, but bounce a check and it will still cost you. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. For weeks, the Obama administration has focused its health care energies on a single opponent, not Republicans, but the health insurance industry. Today, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius took the fight to the Lion's Den, the annual Washington meeting of the industry's trade group. NPR's Julie Rovner was there.
Yesterday, the streets around the Ritz-Carlton in downtown Washington were filled with thousands of anti-health insurance industry protesters.
What do we want?
Health care.
Where do we want it?
Now.
But today, the demonstrators had gone home, and the mood inside the hotel was a lot more, well, polite. Here's how Secretary Sebelius, a former insurance commissioner, greeted insurance trade group CEO Karen Ignani.
She was kind enough to send me the dress code memo today, gray suit, blue shirt, so I appreciate those nice touches.
Sebelius also said the administration's crusade against insurance companies hiking premiums was not intended to be a personal attack on the people who work at those health plans.
I am certainly not here to vilify hardworking employees of insurance companies across the country or blame insurance companies for all the problems in our healthcare system.
But then the message, if not the tone, shifted. Sebelius warned that if the current effort fails, health insurers could soon find themselves in deep trouble.
Premiums will take even a bigger bite out of Americans' wages. Your market will shrink even further. More Americans will lose their employer-sponsored insurance, and we will have a situation where the market is unsustainable.
But the heart of Sebelius's message was to urge, in a nice way, that the industry shift its lobbying tactics.
Instead of spending energy attacking the parts of the proposal that you don't like, come to the table with strengthening the parts that are there that you talked about from the beginning are essential to comprehensive reform.
That would mean pulling television ads like this one unveiled just this week.
Health insurance companies' costs are only 4% of all healthcare spending. Doctors, hospitals, medicines, and tests are the biggest slices.
But industry group head Karen Ignani insisted her group is eager to support an overhaul of the current system, including major changes in the way insurance is delivered, just not this one.
As it stands, we're concerned that the legislation now will make costs go up, not down.
The insurance industry says one huge problem is that Congress has so far been too timid to adequately punish people who won't buy insurance under the new requirement the bill would impose.
If we have legislation that has de minimis penalties and doesn't include everyone and isn't effectively an incentive for everyone to participate, the people who are left in the pool are the oldest and the ones who have the highest health care costs.
Which would, in turn, raise premiums for those who do buy insurance. Sebelius invited the industry to offer suggestions to improve the legislation. Ignani said they would. But time is running short, and the White House doesn't seem to be backing off its criticism of the industry. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
The nation's largest school system is reeling from a budget crisis, and the Los Angeles Unified School District is bracing for another round of layoffs. One school in Watts, Markham Middle School, has already lost half its teachers, and there may be more pink slips to come. That's where NPR's Ina Jaffe went for this story.
Morning, Maria. Good morning, Johanna.
Students line up outside of Nicholas Melvoin's class as he greets each one of them by name.
Morning, Ruby. Morning, Ken.
Melvoin teaches English as a second language in this school that's more than 70% Latino.
Our class average for this test was a 86%. I still think we can do better, but I was proud.
Melvoin is just 24 years old. He's a Harvard graduate and began teaching right out of college.
I was always interested growing up in education. I have a lot of teachers in my family. So I knew that I wanted to not only teach, but teach in a school like Markham, in a community like Watts.
Which has four large public housing projects and dozens of gangs. A lot of the teachers who came here were, like Melvoin, young, idealistic, and reform-minded. But because layoffs are decided on the basis of seniority, they were the first to go when the layoffs came last June. Melvoin is now one of about a dozen who came back to Markham as long-term substitutes.
My job description didn't change. If anything, actually, my responsibilities increased. I became a department chair. So I came back and actually took on more leadership roles, even though I was being paid by the hour.
And getting no sick days or vacation pay. Markham Middle School has had to get by with a lot of subs this year, but not all are familiar faces like Melvoin.
In my history class this year, we had so many different substitutes, it was a blur. They write their name on a board, and the next day it will be gone, and so were they.
That's Markham 8th grader Cheryl Reed. She's a plaintiff in a lawsuit that claims that teacher layoffs have had a far greater impact on schools that serve poor communities. She spoke at a news conference at the school.
It's not fair for my school to lose so many teachers. It feels like we're a lower class school and we're not thought about as much as other schools.
When I came on board, I had a young individual come to me and ask me, so how long will you be here? And that just hit me like a ton of bricks.
Tim Sullivan became principal of Markham in 2008. He was hired to lead a reform effort after the school became one of a dozen taken over by L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa. New teachers embraced reform, he says, and the school reinforced that with special training.
One of the things that hurts us, again, financially is we invest professional development, thousands of dollars into these teachers and programs, and that training goes right out the window. And then it's, you know, training a new batch.
And veteran teachers, says Sullivan, are not jumping at the chance to work at Markham.
As we started the school year, I still had open positions.
So he hired teachers who'd been pushed out of their old jobs at other schools, but they changed their minds.
Because folks had gone home looked up Markham on the internet, did their research. They chose to send in letters of resignation, never even arriving on my campus.
It was almost Christmas before all the positions at Markham were filled with either full-time teachers or long-term subs.
Who can raise their hand and remind me what genre means? What is genre?
Nicholas Melvoin now counts as one of the full-time teachers. He was reinstated in January, but expects to be laid off again in June. Ina Jaffe, NPR News.
We're taking the long view this week, our occasional series with people of long experience. Today, a man of faith and fight, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, whose new book is called Made for Goodness. During apartheid, Archbishop Tutu railed against the injustice and inhumanity of South Africa's government. Now 78, in a magenta habit with a silver crucifix around his neck, he is the picture of a holy man. Looking back on his boyhood in a black township, Archbishop Tutu remembers an urchin with a fondness for marbles and comic books, which led me to ask, did you like going to church as a child?
We had fun. I mean, I still remember things like, if God be for us, if God be for us, who can be against us? Who can be against us, against us? And it was a fantastic thing to have much, much later to remember. Yes, if God before us in our struggle against injustice and oppression, who can be against us? But yeah, and I have to say, the first Anglican priest I met was an incredible human being, a black priest. And we used to go with this priest to farms where he had mission churches. The priest was treated like a big chief, you know, when he arrived. I mean, each time I still remember this incredible priest who had this degree of caring for lesser mortals. And who knows? I mean, I was probably seeking to emulate him.
As a teenager, you nearly died of tuberculosis.
Yes.
You spent months institutionalized in a TB hospital. And for someone that at that age, you suddenly see the possibility of your own death.
Yes. Yes, I was in hospital for 20 months. We were in a general ward. And I'd observed in the ward that almost all of the patients who coughed up blood ended up going to the, you call it a morgue, we call it a mortuary. And one day, this thing happened to me. I coughed, and the blood just came gushing out of my mouth. And I sat, and I still can't believe that that happened, but I sat there, and I said to God, well, if it means I'm going to die, that's okay. I don't think I've ever felt that same kind of peace, the kind of serenity that I felt after acknowledging that maybe I was going to die of this TB.
It was interesting to find out in the book that your first idea of who you would be, what your career would be, was that you would be a doctor. But yes, you couldn't afford to go to medical school.
Yes.
And then ultimately, to go into the ministry, you described what? That you were grabbed by the scruff of the neck by God?
Well, I mean, my first love was medicine. And especially after getting TB, I was determined I wanted to be able to find a cure. But I was admitted to medical school, but my parents didn't have the money to pay the fees. So, you know, one of my favorite prophets is Jeremiah. In part, it is because Jeremiah is such a crybaby, and I also tend to be a crybaby. I holler at the drop of a hat, as it were. But Jeremiah also was saying he didn't want to become a prophet and said to God, if I say I don't want to speak on your behalf, your word is like a fire in my breast. I can't hold it back. And sometimes when people asked why I was going on in the fashion I was, despite the reaction of the government and all of their nastinesses, and I said, well, although we claim that we have a free will, in some ways, God just grabs us by the scruff of the neck, and willy-nilly you have to do what it is that God wants you to do.
Jumping ahead to the late 1990s, you were asked by Nelson Mandela to become the chairman of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Yes.
You had to sit through some very terrible stories.
Yeah.
Some of them, many of them, we couldn't relate right now on a morning radio show. Did you ever find that your faith in the basic goodness of people was shaken?
No. Perhaps if one had listened only to the atrocities, an account of the atrocities that people committed, but we were constantly being bowled over by the extent to which people were ready and willing to forgive. But, I mean, we had, obviously, the spectacular example of Nelson Mandela, who could come out of 27 years incarceration so eager to be able to forgive.
Have you found that your relationship to God has changed as you've grown older?
Yes. I am learning to shut up more in the presence of God. You know, previously, I mean, you want, and I still do, I mean, you have a kind of shopping list that you bring to God. But more and more, I think you are trying to grow in just being there. Like when you sit in front of a fire in winter, you are just there in front of the fire, and you don't have to be smart or anything. The fire warms you.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, thank you very much for joining us.
God bless you. Thank you.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu's new book is Made for Goodness. Tomorrow, God and Suffering, The Long View with Rabbi Harold Kushner. If you're someone whose cable bill is going up, here's a story for you. Cable companies are paying more for content, so they're passing those costs on to you. But there are ways to reduce the bill if you are willing to work at it, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
A decade or so ago, if you wanted lots of TV channels, you probably turned to your cable company. For telephone service, the phone company. And for internet access, still another company. But for some consumers, at least, there is another option.
We have the DVR, internet, cable, HD, and telephone, all bundled together for like $88 a month or something like that.
Ann Pearson, a Seattle area realtor, is taking advantage of the so-called triple play. Companies like Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon now offer a bundle of services for a set price.
It's like half the price of what we had when we were doing it separately. We have a good deal.
The best deals often come as introductory offers. And after the introductory period, companies are free to raise prices. The increases are sometimes 50% or more. But Paul Reynolds of Consumer Reports says if there's more than one company offering video service where you live, you may be in luck.
More neighborhoods are getting what's called fiber optic service, put there primarily by the phone companies, It's not in every neighborhood in America, but where it is there, we're starting to get competition between it and cable.
By playing the phone company and the cable company and possibly the satellite TV company against each other, you have leverage. Ben Scott of the consumer advocacy group Free Press says where competition is keen, companies will work hard to get you to sign up. And once you're a customer, they don't want to lose you.
This is one of sort of the last areas in the U.S. economy where you can still haggle with them about how much your service should cost, what kind of features you should get, and they will move the numbers around on your bill until you're satisfied and stay with them. As long as you're over that break-even point for them, they want to keep you.
If there's little or no competition in your neighborhood, however, you'll have to work harder to get the best price. According to the Federal Communication Commission's most recent report, the average monthly price of expanded basic cable service more than doubled between the mid-1990s and 2008. Consumers complain often bitterly about their cable bills. And how does the industry respond?
10 years ago, you may have had 50 or 75 analog-only channels. Today, that's completely flipped, and consumers are watching hundreds of channels.
Brian Dietz, a spokesman for the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, says it's unfair to look only at price because cable subscribers get so much more than they used to.
They have interactive TV services like video on demand and digital video recorders, and they're using the service more and more every day.
But some consumer advocates contend many people are paying for channels and services they don't want. The cable companies have resisted a la carte pricing, where consumers could pay only for the 10 or 12 channels they actually watch. But even if a la carte were adopted, it's not clear it would result in overall lower prices. Cable companies might simply charge a lot for popular channels. There is, of course, another alternative. Go without pay TV of any kind. Put up an antenna and get free broadcast television. Watch your favorite show on the internet or on Netflix, or simply curl up with a good book. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.